done the full course of meditation, or specifically all the jhanas, under Pa-Ok-Sayadaw, that's the one, Pa-Ok-Sayadaw. And he seemed to be very keen on things like vajra bodies and so on. He had a stroke, and he thought that he was in his vajra body, which is some other body other than his body. And it's obviously we're getting into Tibetan stuff here with vajra bodies. But I just wonder, I mean, I would say that if you have a sensation like that, you can interpret, well, you have sensations which you can interpret in all sorts of ways. And if you have been taught to about vajra bodies, you may well interpret your feeling in that sort of a way.
Precisely so. Exactly. That's now, an important point.
Yeah.
Is that we speak in a language that we have heard before in order to describe things that we've never experienced before.
Right. I mean, I could say that I have a sensation sometimes of a kind of golden light inside the head or something. Now, I mean, I don't know what that is.
It's called imagination.
Yeah. I mean, I can no doubt find stuff where people will have written about that and said that it's the absolute or the Godhead or who knows what.
Uh-huh. All right.
Well, what are you going to do with this sort of stuff?
Those are events.
Uh-huh.
Okay, they're happenings. They're experiences. They're right. Not lifestyle.
Right.
Right.
So, I mean, so much of this business that you get in all religions is that people have these events which they say are self-validating. And, of course, they are self-validating.
That's because they've got no real validation. They're all experiential.
Yeah. But then, of course, they describe it and people latch onto it. And
of course they do. Everybody's looking for something special. How in the world can we get people back to the point that they're happy with what they've got, which is ordinary?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to start talking about myself particularly, but I did have, I feel that I had quite a, I felt that I could give myself permission rather more than before to enter into and stay in the first jhana. I've always had rather a sense that this is something that one has to be very careful of, because, you know, the Buddha goes on about, assuming that the Buddha did, because we're all dealing with stuff 2,500 years old, and you never know how much is original and how much is stuff that's crept in. But
actually, we're beginning to discover that. We fairly well know what's really old. We do know that the Majjhima Nikaya was done right after his death. We're fairly established that the Dhamma Nikaya was done about 150 years later, during the time, the height of the Asoka era.
Mm-hmm.
And we do know that a lot of the literature during the Asoka era was collected together to take it to Sri Lanka.
Uh-huh.
And we've also begun to figure out that because of that collection from a wide variety of places all over India, many of the suttas are actually written in different language dialects.
Is that right? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so when you have suttas and you're translating them out of the Pali, what you're actually doing is translated out of more than one dialect.
Uh-huh.
Now, the framework of that dialect was called Magadhi.
Uh-huh.
But we can also fairly well establish that things like commentaries and Abhidhamma,
Yes, much
in
later.
Later books like Visuddhimagga and Paddhisiddhimagga, those books were done 1,000 years or 500-600 years after the time of the Buddha, and therefore can be deemed unreliable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you're going to find most of the magic.
Yes.
Much later stuff. But you'll also find magical stuff in the Majjhima Nikaya too, and the possibility is that's been dicked with. The question is when was it dicked with? Was it dicked with during the Asoka period? Was it dicked with as it was being done?
Do you have an example, Dhammarato?
Pardon?
Do you have an example? An example.
Okay, yes. An example would be Majjhima Nikaya number 20, where the Buddha talks a lot about rebirth. And it appears that he is talking magic, but it's possible that he's actually talking metaphorically, and everybody in the hall knows that he's speaking metaphorically, because at the end of the sutta, it specifically says, therefore, do not get reborn. As if everybody had a choice about it. Well, guess what we do?
Ah, I see. That makes sense.
Okay, now, the choices that we have about being reborn are in fact two areas. One of the areas is if you take rebirth moment by moment, and understand that all you have to do to not get reborn is just don't go there. Don't have those kind of unwholesome thoughts. Stay in wholesome thoughts and you will not be reborn in those woeful states of hell or an animal or a preta or an asura, because you don't go there. Now, also, it's been said many places by a number of different monks that I'm not coming back. Now, that can be said in one of two ways. And the way that it appears that they're saying it is that I know enough about reality, including who's come back, who has not come back, what conditions they do come back, if they do come back, etc., like that, that I feel safe and secure, I ain't coming back. Now, what that actually means is that they don't believe that they were ever going to come back, but now they have that confidence that they're not coming back rather than the mystery.
So effectively, they're confident that when they're dead, they're going to be dead.
Yeah, and that's nice enough. Being dead is good enough.
Well, if it's good enough, you see, this is the trouble. I mean, the whole of humanity seems to want to have, Brazington calls an immortality project.
Yes, it's the living who are dissatisfied with the possibility of death, just like the teenager does not want to go to college because he's never been there.
Mm-hmm.
Or the teenager does not want to go into the army, because he's never been there. And all he's heard is bad stories. Well, you see, you're coming from a different age group. Remember, yeah. I'm talking about a teenager, okay? So that's the point is that it's the fear of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And yet all of those stories, but no evidence.
Indeed.
Is there any evidence of Christian heaven or hell? Is there any evidence of Islamic heaven or hell? Is there any evidence of Hindus, heavens, hells, being reborn as an animal, being reborn as a human? What we have is stories.
Well, yes, but most of evidence is stories. You go into a court and that's what you hear.
Absolutely. And the whole teaching and the whole practice of the Buddha is stop with the stories about events and the stories about experiences, and let's stay with reality. Because reality, when you discover it, winds up being okay, good enough. And so the dead who are dead, they don't complain about being dead. It's only the living who complain about being dead or dying.
Mm.
When someone dies, it's the living who complain about it, not the dead one. Many people are ready to go.
Uh-huh. Oh,
that's why euthanasia exists, is because people are ready to go.
Yeah.
Okay. So being ready to go should be part of your practice.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the time comes and it's time to go, hey, I'm, you know, my train has arrived. I'm climbing on board happily. I'm not going to be put on that train kicking and screaming and wanting something to be different. I don't want to go. I don't want to go. Now, this is in part due to the self-preservation instinct.
Of course.
And instinctively, we don't want to die. That's part of what keeps us alive. That's what keeps a child from running in the road just at the wrong time. But it doesn't keep all kids from running in the road. Some of them get run over because they're not watching where they're going. So that happens on all occasions. But now we're coming to back to that sutta number 20 to figure out that, wait a minute, we've got choices here. And I would choose not to be reborn. I also leave the possibility that maybe there is something that's going to forcibly make me be reborn. I don't know what's after it. Nobody's ever given a definitive answer. Not one dead person has ever published a book on death. All they ever do is living people publish books on dying.
Indeed, indeed. Well, of course, that's a big Tibetan thing, isn't it? With the
it is Tibetan, but it's not Buddhist. Remember, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is an old, old, old book. That was
is that where the Bardo comes in?
Yeah, that's where the Bardo comes in, and all of that happened before Buddhism came to Tibet.
Is that right? Now, that's something I didn't realize. Yeah. But I mean, what they seem to, well, I mean, the way I would look at that is that they've got instances, presumably, of people who, well, they do have people who have near-death experiences. We know that that's a lot of that's getting written up nowadays.
Yeah, and but that's an important point, that it's an experience.
It's an experience, and they're not, when they recount the experience, they're not dead.
Exactly. Right. But that experience did not happen in reality. That experience happened in the mind. But in fact, one of the things about it, where people have been talking about, I floated up out of my body. Mm-hmm. And so a number of doctors, this happened for years, a number of doctors would have great big signs, neon signs, light, brightly lit signs that were placed on top of shelving in the operating theater. So that if somebody did have an out-of-body experience and rose above to see what was happening, they should have seen that sign, and nobody ever sees the signs. All they have is the feeling of floating. And feeling of floating is not actually out of the body floating. It's a feeling. It's an experience. And well, 99% of all, go ahead.
The interesting part of it seems to be the question you know, once your vital signs stop, is there anything else still going on in the nervous system that isn't being detected at the level we can detect at the moment?
Ah, that's an important question. And in fact, that's the point, is 100 years ago, they would detect death by holding a mirror under the nose.
That's right.
And if somebody was dead, they stopped putting smog on the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Except that you can get the mirror warming up his body temperature, and then somebody breathing doesn't put smog on the mirror.
Well, they know about that. I mean, they knew about that.
They didn't know about that 150 years ago, though.
Well, they did, because you got condensation. Everybody knows about condensation. You may not know that it is condensation, but it's an it's a common experience.
It's a modern scientific knowledge, but in the old days they weren't relying upon scientific knowledge.
Yeah, but you get condensation in a house because if it's cold outside and you've got glass, you've got condensation on glass, and they had glass back in the way back when.
Right.
It wasn't really good glass, but they had glass. And if you were warm and wet in a room, as humans are, with a fire in there.
But here's the point. If they knew 150 years ago that holding a mirror or a piece of glass under the nose of someone who they were testing to see was dead or not, they would have known then it was not reliable. But people got buried left, right, and center because they weren't breathing enough.
Yeah, they would have known that's right enough. If they knew that a warm mirror does not condense, then as you do by observation, you don't need science for it. You just need observation.
Right, and a whole lot of people are spilled too busy feeling and not looking and investigating, observing. Okay. Do you know that, in fact, during that era, that they actually sold coffins with mechanisms on them so that the person who was buried in the coffin could ring a bell?
I have read of that.
All right. I have. Which means that the methods of testing whether someone was dead or not was unreliable.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this happened recently in India. There was a woman who was about to be cremated, and then she opened her eyes.
Yeah.
So it's still not reliable.
So people who were comatose way back when, instead of being hospitalized and hooked up to all kinds of equipment, and then they still have that. When are you going to pull the plug is the big question that happens often.
Yes.
What do they mean by pulling the plug is are the vital signs strong enough to keep a dead piece of meat alive?
Mm-hmm.
And so what the point of death is, we only know that it's a process, and deep into that process, for instance, the body grows cold, the life goes out of the eyes, rigor mortis sets in, the body begins to decay and rot. Mm-hmm. Okay. But a body just laying on the ground who has just been recently shot, you don't know whether he's dead or alive. You don't have any pulse, but that's no guarantee. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they often take pulse from the arms, and when a body is in bad shape, it will contract and have all the blood circulating just between the heart and the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and mm-hmm. so the cops coming by and checking for a pulse is no guarantee that somebody's dead or not.
Well, I suppose that's why you feel for the carotid artery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, what we do know, though, is that when the body begins to starve for blood and the brain begins to starve for blood and starve for oxygen, it begins to malfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And it malfunctions in the state that we would call experience. It begins to experience malfunctioning. And so people who have that kind of malfunction, they begin to function again. They come back with stories about floating out of their body. They have experiences of light and traveling And some of them even have stories about, I met my granddaughter and my grandmother, my granddaughter or grandmother or whoever that we met along that journey into that light told us, oh, it's not your time. You've got to go back.
Yep, yep, that's the one.
All right, so those are the ones that have an experience. And the real teaching of the Buddha is not about a particular experience. It's about how does that experience, if you're going to let it, actually change your life. So when people have an out-of-the-body experience, in fact, I forgot who it was, but his name, excuse me, he was a very famous writer. And in World War I, he got shot. He almost died. He had an out-of-the-body experience. He came back to write about it. He was quite a popular writer.
Tolkien?
Huh?
Tolkien?
I don't think so.
R.R. Tolkien?
R.R. Tolkien? I don't know. I don't remember. But I do know that since medical science and anesthesiology and a lot of surgeries that go after people who would normally have died anyway and bring them back from the brink. They have all of these stories and imaginations about what happened. Well, guess what? Mm-hmm. People who were sitting in a dull state of mind called meditation, when they're not breathing well, they can have these kind of experiences also. Because the mind gets starved from oxygen, the heart rate goes down. They've actually experimented with that, that people, in fact, who are experienced meditators, their blood flow goes shallow. Their blood pressure drops low. Their breathing is not good. That, in fact, fourth jhana is probably fairly close to death in those vital signs. And so if you are not well trained, then those are the kind of experiences, and people are going to come out of those kind of meditation experiences with all kinds of fanciful things that they dreamt up while their body and the mind was starved and in a state.
So maybe it's a good thing to have a bit of the hindrance of skeptical doubt.
Actually, I would say that in a humorous sort of way, yes, that's true. But a better way of saying it is that no, what we really need to do is to learn to control the mind, to control the body, and to control the way that we feel. And that's why the Buddha recommended first jhana, because we're breathing well, we're thinking sharply, we're watching what's going on. And he did not recommend fourth jhana as something that was necessary for anyone. But one of the things that we do know is that we need to come up with enough observation of that stuff to recognize that when perceptions stop, feelings stop, which means that those people who are having out-of-the-body experiences, their perception and their feelings are probably running pretty wild with whatever left they've got of oxygen, rather than being able to slow things down and bring it to a halt while you're fully conscious, fully awake, fully careful, fully oxygenated. And this is what the Buddha would recommend. And yet very few people, even some old, old Buddhist masters, have not been doing the practice of what the Buddha taught. They've been practicing whatever their old traditions had, of going very close to the state of death because they're not breathing well. There's, in fact, a whole set of procedures. They practice this in Thailand. And one of the ways that they practice it is the guy, as he gets fairly close to death, he changes his diet. And one of the diet ways of doing it is to eat only raisins and dates. have a diet of raisins and dates. Why? Because it's heavy duty sugar, not much moisture, and that helps dry out the body. Okay, there's other bodily things that they can do so that the body will actually preserve. Now, the reason that the body is well preserved is because the body is already on a diet of only raisins and dates. It's already dehydrated. And so these bodies can stay they don't decompose the way that a normal body.
Mummified.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like an awful way to go.
Well, it is rather. I mean, why would you want to do that?
Oh, for the same reason that they will swallow rocks. Why? Because after they're cremated, the rocks will be there among the remains, and that's one of the indications that this guy is a special whoop-de-doo master, because he had stones in his body. Well, he swallowed the darn things.
Is that how they get it? I mean, yes, you get these stories about sort of rainbow particles and so on after the guy has died, you know, and been cremated, whatever. I didn't realize they did by swallowing rocks.
Right. And the guys who were staying at that monastery, the ones who feed him the dates and feed him the stones, because their monastery is going to get really famous later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is all about human activity and human greed, and it's got this magical quality to it. And the magic is that somehow or another, I'll live forever. I'll learn to fly.
Oh, yes. We've got a fair amount of that in Christianity, people flying about the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they do that in Japan as well.
Yeah, yes. It's a worldwide human stupidity.
Yeah.
And the whole point of the teaching of the Buddha, in fact, the whole point of living in general is, can you have fun right now? Can you have a good life right now? Can you remember that you don't have to go do any of that kind of stuff? You can actually be okay. Can you be okay moment by moment by moment in this life, this now, the next my moment, the next life, the next now, one after another, and enjoy the frigging load out of your life? That's the question.
Now, this brings me back in a sort of a roundabout way to the point I was trying to get at before we got sidetracked onto upajayas and all that kind of thing and technicalities of the Buddhist monasteries. And that was to say, one of the problems that I've had and always had with entering into, well, with PT in particular, I've said that I often get sort of very strong bodily stuff going on with the PT. And this seems to me that it is in effectively physical pleasure. And the Buddha seems to have been very much against it. And he was always ranting on, was he not?
No.
But was he not always going on about
wait a minute, don't keep going on because I'm not listening because you made a statement and let's straighten that out. The Buddha was not against pleasure. And the best place that I can show you that is in Sutta number 36 when he actually says, why am I against the pleasures of the first jhana? They have nothing to do with sensuality.
So, under the apple tree, right?
Under the apple tree scene, yes. That's right. The whole point of it was is that when he came to understand and that you can see that there's a big difference between sitting quietly and feeling really good versus going to the brothel, going to the races, driving fast, getting drunk, robbing a store. I mean, wow, don't you really get pumped up when you go rob a store?
Haven't ever tried it, actually, but maybe if I have a next life, I'll get around to it.
But it's pumped up with fear, just like driving really, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Or going on roller coasters. People are seeking thrills.
I love horror movies.
Movies are full of that. It gives that that adrenaline kick.
The whole of this idea of sensual pleasures being filthy pleasures and so on surely means
they're not
that you
filthy
shouldn't.
In and of themselves. They're dangerous.
Surely means that you should be avoiding them. So he shouldn't be going to horror movies, because it's he should be getting into the first genre and sitting.
People have been known to die in their theater seats in horror movies.
Uh-huh.
Scared to death, literally.
Uh-huh.
Okay, people have been known to have chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and some new kids on the block by going to brothels.
Okay, of course you do, yes.
People have been known to have cirrhosis of the liver, as well as falling down and being face down in mud because of alcohol.
I'm sure we all know somebody who's fallen down drunk and hit his head and died.
Precisely so. Okay. So this is what we're getting at, is that the sensual pleasures, when pursued, are dangerous. And they're especially dangerous. Okay. They're
Thank
especially
you
dangerous. We'll see you later, Daniel.
Cheers, Ed. Nice to talk to you.
All right. Yeah. They're especially dangerous when people don't get what they're wanting out of those, let us say, practices, and go back and do it over and over again until finally they do have some real damage.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're actually looking at is that the first jhana, including the rapture and the pity and the good feelings and the kundalini racing up your back and good breathing and well-maintaining, there's no danger in that unless you're doing it at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, you see, I've had to get past the feeling that there is a danger in that, because and this is all to do with childhood prohibitions, because, you know, the sort of there is a sexual element in all this.
Yes, there is.
That was so much beaten down in childhood and adolescence by one's upbringing.
I don't think that they were as hard on it in Asia and other places as they still are in Western culture. I think the Catholic Church had an especially harsh influence on Western mindsets,
yeah,
that they haven't gotten over it yet.
They haven't got it, and the Prods took it with them. You know, mm-hmm. the Protestants.
All took it with them and whipped it into real shape. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
But in fact, here's something really funny about Christianity. If God was so against sex, why did he invent it in the first place?
Well, because he wanted more Christians. Quite simple.
Yeah, who needs babies?
And in fact, it was the Jews who invented that, because it was the Jews who really invented, as I understand it, the concept of any sex that was done that was not for having babies was to be frowned on, because you want more babies in the tribe.
Right, exactly. And the tribe in this case is often the Catholic Church. But here's the point about that. Having babies, historically, has been dangerous.
Well, it's the Buddha's mother died. There's too many people.
Right. that's one thing is dangerous about sex, is we can have too many people.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of it is the danger is that the human race could die out, but that may not be a bad thing at all.
Well,
humans, I think, are let us say, overinflated egos as to how marvelous humanity is. I think that the apes and the animals get along just fine without humans.
Well, I'm sure they will, but they'll not even be apes and animals the way that where we're going. There might be a few cockroaches.
But here's the point is that they don't have prohibitions against sex. They have styles. An example of it is a female dog does not have big tits. She does not go and have silicone breasts. In fact, her tits are the same size as the male tits unless she's pregnant or getting into season. And male dogs don't have much of anything to do with female dogs unless the female is in season.
Well, that's the whole
point. But human women are in season 24 hours a day.
Yes. Well, it varies a bit in the menstrual cycle, but yes.
Well, yes, that's fertility, but they'll jump in bed any opportunity unless she's got a training. Unless she's been told not to.
Well, she's usually told not to at great length because...
because she's likely to just jump right in bed. That's the human way of doing things. Let's go play with it.
Sure. Well, we all do that.
Okay, and part of that is because humans are smart enough to know how to go look for pleasure. But they're just stupid enough to not realize how dangerous some of those pleasures are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so hence back to the teaching of the Buddha about the jhana is that he says, why am I afraid of the pleasures that I receive in jhana? Because they're not the same thing as the sensual pleasures that have dangers associated with them.
And so
there's problems with the translations, and I think that the problem is the word sensual. Okay, sensual can mean senses, but it almost always doesn't. Almost always sensual means sexual.
Of course.
Just like the word love does not always mean liking, it sometimes is a sexual thing.
Yes, sure. Okay. Sure.
Just like Freud said, and the funny one is that he says that sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, but most of the time is phallic.
Oh God, when I was I was very interested in mainly because I was very interested. I read stuff by, I think I read at least one book by Alfred Adler, and certainly something by one of his one of his disciples, if you like, because I was very interested in the inferiority complex, because as a 15-year-old, I thought I had one. I probably didn't. I probably just felt inferior, but there it was. And I mean, I did read some Freudian stuff. And, you know, Charlie Chaplin's Umbrella, oh, for God's sake, give me a break. You know, that's a penis. Give me a break. But there we are. You find yourself unable to, you know, it's not just, there's all sorts of things you're unable to believe. And you're going up and saying, give me a break.
So that's one of the things then that we can say is that sitting alone, sitting quietly, breathing well, and having marvelous thoughts and bringing up feelings are of pleasure, etc., are generally not sexual.
Yeah, breathing, by the way, you bring up something there that I wonder about. I mean, I've heard you talking to various people about taking command of the breath and, you know, breathing in very deeply and effectively.
Not very, you're not just somewhat deeply. Very deeply is an extreme.
Right. Because
you added the word very, I did.
Well, I thought that's what you meant, because I thought that you should start by, getting as much air in as possible.
No, I would say, no. In fact, about 80%, to fill up about 80% and go down to about 30%. And most people go from 40 to 60.
What I've found actually, sort of watching the breath is attendant, well, and I do find this is helpful to me, is I take in a lot of breath and I get it up sort of to what I feel is as much as it will take. I let it go out quickly, and then I leave it to its own devices to keep on going out. And then at the end, there is a sort of feeling that, well, if I want to get it all out, then I'm going to pull up in the abdomen so as to push up on the diaphragm, you see, and get more out. And
I have seen people at the gas station jumping on the bumper of their car to get a last glass full of air out of the tank so that they can put another glass full of less than a pint of more gasoline in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've seen meditators do that same sort of thing, to where we're not trying for an extreme.
Right. So we're not trying for an extreme. So we get the breath going, but then there is a tendency when all the sort of feelings arise to let the breath go and do its own thing. So you're
right, which is a mistake. That will help take you out of the jhana. That's the funny thing too, that watching the breath and having long, easy breathing, and we get ourselves into a big, beautiful state, and then we forget all about the breathing and pay attention instead to the states that we're in, and that's why the states don't last.
Mm-hmm.
That we need to continue to enjoy the breathing along with the process.
Right,
To not let it go, but to make sure that we're getting enough oxygen. In fact, what will happen is after people do that, they'll stop paying attention to the breathing. Their body is already oxygenated. The automatic system then will just shut it all down. And now we begin within, let us say, 1 or 2 minutes, the body goes from completely oxygenated world functioning into oxygen starvation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then, sometimes the sort of thrills of the piti cause one to breathe deep, cause one to take a deep breath.
Sometimes.
Sometimes you get that.
But the piti generally doesn't last for a long time. It peaks and then it comes back.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Just pleasure.
Yes. Well, that's where you're sitting, breathing. He trains himself for breathing in. I fully experience sukha, presumably. That's the point of,
And that sukha is feeling safe, secure, comfortable, and satisfied. And the pity is that high when we say, I could do this. That's the success. And we need to have both a little bit of the pity and the sukha together, but we have to keep breathing well, because otherwise the breathing will stop and then it goes downhill again.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes into those states where people have these really, really weird experiences, like lights and going through tunnels and grannies at the other end saying, go back, go back.
Yes, well. I'm actually... Yeah, well, I'm straying into sort of territory that I, you know, you're recording. I don't want to talk about stuff that happens to me so much.
Well, we don't have to talk about it in that sense. We can talk about it in a general sense. Then, in fact, that's you hear me not talking about my own personal experiences.
But that's like the girl going into the chemist and saying, I want a pregnancy test because my friend thinks she's pregnant, you know. I mean, it's fairly obvious what you're actually saying in that situation. You're not talking generally.
But there's a difference between going into the pharmacy and saying, my girlfriend needs advice, and running down the street whooping and hollering about the results of your pregnancy test.
You mean hopefully the negative results?
Yeah, yes. There's a middle path in there someplace. And so it's okay to not talk about experiences, especially in the sense of bragging.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right.
Because other people, when they hear talking about it, they get jealous. They get greedy. Oh, I want that. I've heard a news story.
Yes. Yes. Well, I won't brag, but I'm saying I think I've had a little bit of success recently. So,
well, I congratulate you on having success. Continue to enjoy it.
I
do. But one thing that's true, and that is the success that you have while you're sitting quietly is better than the success of going on Reddit to brag.
Oh, yeah. Well, anytime I open up Reddit, of course, it wants me to join or something. I have to sign in. I don't do that.
Well, that's what Reddit wants. The people on Reddit who's already signed up, they want to argue.
Sure. Well, arguing's fun.
Yeah. Well, going to the brothel is fun. But it's dangerous. Driving really fast at 120 miles an hour is a lot of fun. But it's dangerous.
Yeah. Sure. I'm just fiddling about.
Can we have all the fun that we want and do it safely?
Fiddling about with wires and chargers and things here, because I'm running out of power on this computer. Okay. Yes.
So that's good. The way that we can talk about it is, can you find a safe way to have pleasure? So that it's not dangerous, it's not dukkha. You see, that's the problem with all that sensual pleasure, racing their car, going to the brothels, chatting up the girls, getting drunk, bragging on Reddit, and all of that kind of stuff has dangers to it.
And
the danger is we become dissatisfied somehow or another, either through the cirrhosis of the liver or because we actually do get in an argument with somebody on Reddit and he makes a point that we don't like. And so now I'm suffering. Because I was arguing with somebody on Reddit and he won. Oh my. That's almost as bad as the clap.
Yeah.
So, can we find a safe way to find pleasure? Can we, in fact, be safe without having extremes of pleasure? Just a little bit, a little dabble, do you?
Well, we have to give ourselves permission to take that pleasure because so much.
Of course, because a lot of our culture has denied us permission.
Indeed. I mean, the general theory seemed to be, one found it a bit off-putting as a child, certainly, or as a young person. You're supposed to deny yourself for 70, 80 years, however many years you've got. And then you go to heaven. Well, yeah.
Yeah, well, what are you going to get in heaven?
Well, I mean, I don't know what you're going to get in heaven.
Your penis has already shrunk down to the size of a dried grape.
Hmm. Yeah.
Not only that, but all of those people who got forgiveness for their sins, they're the ones who are going to be in heaven, robbing you blind, picking your pocket, telling you what to do and where to go. I mean, who needs a Saint Peter anyway?
Well, you're going
I mean, another politician, maybe Saint Putin.
That's a happy thought, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Joined with Saint Hitler.
I can do without heaven, thank you very much. I'd Saint much rather be dead.
Well, of course, never mind about heaven. It's much better than hell, much better than burning for all eternity sort of thing.
Mm. Well, if you think about it, heaven is only the ultimate or the extreme form of I like it. Mm-hmm. And hell is only the extreme form of I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And death is the exact dead center middle of those two things, where there's no liking or not liking.
Yeah, but. I mean, surely the middle is to try and have something to like, even if you don't have to like it too much.
Yeah.
Or dislike it too much.
All right, that's the whole point. Then, can we live our lives liking it without wanting it too much?
Mm. Whoops. Looks like you're getting somebody else on. Yeah. Well, I'd better.
Got kind of noisy here for a second.
Oh, that's a call coming in, isn't it? I think. Anyway, you've got a caller. So maybe it's time for me to go. Or in the words of Deputy Dog, the time has come for me to go, for us to go, and we'll be back with another show. Anyway, there we are. Okay.
I'm just sitting here quietly waiting for, there it goes, finally it stopped. Okay. So what did you have been saying for the past 2 minutes? I couldn't hear a thing.
What are you waiting for?
Because if somebody was calling, it was ringing.
Oh, right.
You could hear it in your background.
Yes, I hear it in the background.
But it's blasting my ears.
Oh, geez. Right, I got you. No, I was just saying you've got another call coming in, and I should go.
All right, well, let's go have fun. You go that way and have fun, and I'll go this way and have fun, and everything is all right. No heavens, no hells needed.
Enjoy. Thanks a lot for this talk. It's been good.
I enjoy it. I always do, Jerry. I really like our talks together.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see you later.
Well, I suppose that is why I think I shouldn't be calling Damarato, because I have nothing to say to him. But
but every time you do, you wind up with a mouthful and an earful.
Well, yes, this is also true. Okay, cheers then. Bye-bye.
All righty. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.